Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
We acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country, particularly the local traditional owners, the Yuggera and the Turrbal people. Good morning to all of our listeners tuning in across the National Indigenous Radio Service. And of course, all of our elders listening. And when we say elders, we also mean the elders of all more recent arrivals. We're joined in the studio this morning with, well, first of all, our usual co-host, Bo Spiram. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning, Carver. How are you going?
Very good. And we're joined by a very special guest, Professor Henry Reynolds. Welcome.
Oh, nice to be here.
We're very glad and very happy that we could have you here. For those who don't know Professor Henry Reynolds, you're a renowned author from the historical works that you've conducted over many years, and a very well-regarded and highly awarded historian. What brings you to Brisbane, Henry, on this occasion?
Well, it's always nice to be in Brisbane, but specifically I'm here to talk tomorrow about war and peace in an event in the Anglican Cathedral.
Very good. I think it's probably an important topic at the moment, given the state of particularly international affairs. We're seeing President-elect, well, he's not President-elect now, he is President, Donald Trump, in his sort of squaring off with North Korea over nuclear war. Are these, you know, some of the themes that you're going to be sort of talking about or touching
on? Well, I'm really talking about the situation that Australia's in. That is of being very close to a great power. Now, Australians think that makes them safe, but my view is it's a very dangerous place to be, because you get involved in the fights that engage the great power. That is, you get into fights with the enemies of America. Hence, we've been in the Middle East since 2002. An area of the world we know nothing about, we have no great interest there, that doesn't directly threaten us, and there's no indication of when we'll cease being there. There's also the possibility of further wars against Iran. In this part of the world, there's a real possibility of conflict with China over the South China Sea, and obviously conflict with Korea. So is there any point where we can say no? And it appears there isn't. So it's that situation we're in, of almost seemingly to be perpetually at war, that disturbs me greatly.
This is a long-standing pattern, this following the United States, as well as, I guess, the UK, into conflicts. Why, from your sort of understanding and research, why do you think this is the pattern?
Well, if you go back to the beginning, that is, at the very beginning of Australia, you know, before Federation, all the separate states or colonies, as they were, all went to war in South Africa, beside Britain. Now, the South Africans couldn't possibly threaten Australia. We didn't know much about it. We didn't know much about the war itself, and yet we decided we should go. Now, it was partly that we felt we were part of the empire and we had to do our bit. But it was also this idea that if we help them now, we'll build up a bank of goodwill, which we can draw on when we are threatened. And that seems to be still at the very centre of our thinking. But as I say, it's the expectation that one day they might help us, but in the meantime, we've got to go to war all the time. And lose a great deal of money, but also, even in these modern wars, there are people still get killed, and as we know, people who still get destroyed, physically or psychologically, by their experiences. And the question is, whatever do we gain from it? And I don't think we don't even bother to try and assess what we gain. Now, every other important government activity is assessed. Cost benefit. What did we put in? What did we get out of it? What advantage was there? But we don't do that with war. It's as though war is too important to be considered as something you have to do assessment about. And that, I think, is a terrible situation. And at the moment, neither government or opposition dares discuss that question. What did we gain from the Iraq War, for instance? What did we possibly gain? And is there any way we can avoid doing it again? So these are the sort of issues that I think have been around for a long time, but are very, very relevant today.
There's a it's like a blind allegiance almost, you know.
Yes.
It's that they're going into war and they start the drumbeat, and well, you know, whether it be Malcolm Turnbull or John Howard or whoever else, they sort of fall into line and get in formation and sort of all start marching off. But you know, the thing is they all have that similar history. You know, the US was a British colony at one point, Australia a British colony. And so I guess there's, you know, it poses the question as well, where those allegiances lie.
Well, you know, it's a good question, because even now, you know, you can't claim to be really independent when you have the British Queen as your head of state, which she is. You know, people say, oh, no, she's not really, but she is our head of state. Now, that is an extraordinary situation for an independent country trying to make its way in the world, to have the English monarch as your head of state and to have the English flag. Now, it's not an Australian flag. It's actually in the Flag Act that put it in place. It's called the British Blue Ensign. Now, that is still an extraordinary situation, you know? And in a way, we transferred that sense of allegiance and loyalty from the British to the Americans. And as I remarked before, the closer you are to a great power, the more dangerous it is, because you can't say no.
We speak a bit about this on Let's Talk. We have Chris Graham from New Matilda, previously National Indigenous Times, who comes in a fair bit and joins us for a chat. And we were talking about John Pilger's latest documentary called The Coming War with China. And I guess, you know, there's similar comparisons between what we saw in the Cold War times with, was it Iraq? Being supported by Russia and the US involvement. And we're sort of seeing the same thing again with North Korea. And it's like, they're not actually sort of picking a fight or shirt fronting, as Tony Abbott would say, China. They're sort of going after one of their allies and sort of picking on one of their buddies.
Well, China has said that you know, if North Korea takes the first action, they won't support them. But if the Americans attack North Korea, they will be involved. So it is very, very dangerous. And I mean that is the thing which really disturbs me. Now, in the last century, Australia foolishly, I think, went to war with Britain in 1914. We jumped in. And we lost 70,000 young men, you know, and enormous amounts of treasure. And for what end? You know, we talk about all our victories, but really the First World War was a disaster and we didn't have to be involved. And what worries me, that the great war of the 20th century, which began in 1914 and essentially went to 1945, 30 years of terrible conflict in Europe, may be repeated in this century with a war between America and China. And involving us, that would be even more disastrous. And I can't see any current Australian leader who could say no, who could say in advance, we will not necessarily be involved in a war if you fight with China. And unless we make that sort of preemptive strike, then they will assume all their war plans that they will have will assume that we are going to be there. And that's, as I say, that is the most dangerous idea of all. And yet, you can't see Australia being able to say, we will remain neutral in the event of a conflict between China and the United States.
If I could jump in. And, you know, America's placed itself pretty well within Australia in terms of, you know, Pine Gap. So is that one of the big threats you see?
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, clearly we are totally immersed in American war plans and war planning. We are also totally immersed in their security systems. And there are high-level relationships between the armed forces. And the armed forces themselves, I think, feel that they are in a way engaged with America, it would take a great deal of effort to get out. Now, I say this with some seriousness. If a government, in the eventuality of a war of that kind, was to say, no, Australia will not commit to this, we will remain neutral, I think there is a real possibility there'd be a new dismissal by a Governor General. So I think to be able to have the capacity to make our own decision is almost beyond our reach.
Mm.
And that is terribly worrying, because ultimately, foreign affairs people will say, oh yes, but we talk to the Americans and they listen to us. We've got a lot of influence there. But that is rubbish. The Americans deal with many countries in the world. And the essence of being able to run an empire is to tell each of your little sidelings, saying, oh, you're very important to us. And I don't think Australia has any influence whatsoever in Washington, even though they'll be told, oh, yes, we always listen to you, Australians. You know, we're buddies, you know. But I don't think Australia can really influence. And it's as though you're mounted on a vehicle over which you have no control and which you can't stop.
And I guess, how close do you think, it is going to, it is coming?
Well, people say, oh no, because, economically they're so integrated, it would be so disastrous there can't be a war. But that is exactly what they said in 1914. Because in 1914, it was the first era of globalisation. And there was very, very close connections in Europe. I mean, the royal families were all related. The German, the Russian, the English, they were all they were all cousins. There were strong investment and trade connections, and people said, of course you can't have a war when the economies are so integrated. But that isn't what happened. And so that is the thing which we have to worry about. And that is, I mean, the Chinese themselves are looking very carefully at what happened when you had a new rising power, that is Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Germany was the great ascendant power in Europe. And a war was fought to try and stop that ascension, which has happened now anyway. But it was to stop Germany, you see. And so what we have to ask are two things. Can the American electorate accept being replaced as the world's greatest power?
Well, I know what their answer would be. I think we all know what their answer is.
Yeah. Can they accept having an equal?
Mm.
And secondly, if China is pushed, or if China is threatened with serious internal dissension, will they become more nationalistic and assertive? Now, at the moment, Australia is sending a flotilla of our navy into the South China Sea. They say it's to assert freedom of navigation. Now, no one is threatening navigation. It is simply doing to provoke China and to show the Americans we're on side. Now, that situation in the South China Sea is very, very dangerous. And if the Chinese wanted to be very difficult, they could simply knock out an Australian ship. The Americans would not go to war over an Australian ship, and there's nothing we could do about it. But we are being very provocative and aggressive, and I think that is extremely foolish. Extremely foolish. We could remain out. I mean, there is clearly in East, Northeast Asia in particular, there are all of these great powers, China, Russia, Koreas, Taiwan, China, and then, Vietnam and the Philippines. It is a bit like Europe in 1914. And so it is a dangerous place. Now, Australia could stay out of it if we chose to. But we've got to have the will to do that. And I don't see it there in the government or the opposition. I don't see it anywhere except in, the political groups on the outside like the Greens and all sorts of community organisations. So they are dangerous times. And we simply don't have the capacity to step aside.
To hear you talk there, about the similarities between, Europe in the early the first, was it the First World War, Second
yeah,
World War?
Yeah, 1914.
Yeah, 1914. Mm-hmm. I begs the question, you know, as a historian, do you ever find yourself sort of tearing your hair out that you see history repeating itself? It's like, you know, we've had these conversations before, this is, this is the same sort of thing. It's like we're very slow learners, it appears, when it comes to situations like this.
You'd want to learn. I mean, the extraordinary thing is that Australia, see, Australia committed 20,000 men, gave them to Britain. Do what you like with them. We will let you send them where, we will pay for them. And they did that before the war was declared, at a moment when the British cabinet hadn't even decided to go to war. We said, here, 20,000 of our young men. Now, that is an extraordinary thing to do, giving 20,000 of your young men. And we did the same in the Second World War. That is, we lost 20,000 young men to Japanese prison camp. No, to 16,000 in Singapore became prisoners of the Japanese. They needn't have been there. And we lost 5,000 in Greece and Crete, and they needn't have been there. So sticking close, you know, the empire was for Australia was a very bad idea, and it's still a bad idea. And that's why I think, you know, I think in a way, Indigenous Australians can play an important part in pushing for real independence. You know, our own head of state, our own flag, our own view of the world. A view of the world based on here. You know, this is the place where we will stand and fight, not over there in someone else's country. And that's got to be where you start your defence thinking. And Australia has got great advantages. It's too big for anyone to invade. It's surrounded by water. It is eminently defensible if we wanted to defend ourselves.
It raises the question of, you know, national identity. And I want to talk a bit more about that because we've seen some sort of recent things that have arisen throughout the country that sparked this debate up again about, you know, our history and who we are as a country.
Yeah.
But for, you know, all of our listeners and people out there, if they do want to check out your lecture, it's going to be held tonight, Thursday night, at it's hosted by the United Nations of Australia, United Nations Association of Australia, the Queensland Division, at, where's it, the St. Paul's? St. John's Cathedral. Address?
Anne Street in the city.
St. Paul's Cathedral. St. John's, sorry. St. John's Cathedral in Anne Street, Brisbane City, at 6:30 for a 7 p.m. start. So make sure you get down there. If you do want some information, get in touch with our office, 3892-0100, and we'll make sure that we'll have those details on hand for anyone out there that wants to come and listen. You've raised some really good points there that I'm sure we'll hear more of during your speech. Sorry, Bo, you're going to go?
yeah, just wanted to, you know, all wars and battles that have ever been fought, you know, and whoever wins, you know, or I guess whoever loses, you know, they talk about what their casualties are, whether it's land or their, you know, structure, their hierarchy structure within, you know, I guess a global, you know, look at things. But then, like, the lives are never, you know, the lives lost in war are never, you know, spoken about as, you know, the real casualties, you know, when it comes to war.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we talk a great, you know, we talk about war perhaps more than most countries. I mean, the amount of money that we've spent on commemorating the First World War, the amount of effort, the money that's gone into all sorts of, you know, production and books, And new monuments and doing up old monuments is quite extraordinary. But it's always talk about sacrifice and loss. It's almost never about killing. That is, we, from the far end of the world, went to other countries and killed their young people, killed their young men. We count every single person that died, that is, in the wars over there, not the wars here. But do we ever give an account of the killing we were engaged in? We never do. And we never seem to want to take moral responsibility for that fact. We don't want to take moral responsibility for what we do. And so the great emphasis in every time it's spoken about in lectures and speeches and articles is the question of how they fought.
Mm.
Did they stand up to the digger tradition? You know, were they worthy diggers? There's all this talk about how they fought, not why they fought.
Mm.
And why they fought is the important question. I mean, if you say, well, they were very brave warriors, well, that's true. But, look, probably the bravest people in the Second World War were the Japanese soldiers of the Imperial Army and the German soldiers of the Wehrmacht in defeat. You know, in hopeless odds, they kept on fighting. But we never say, oh, they were great warriors, because we say their cause was bad. But we just assume that we can always think that we were virtuous. And when it comes to one of our most recent wars, that is the war in Iraq, there's no doubt that it was an illegal war. There's no doubt that those involved, you know, should be indicted as war criminals. Tony Blair might be. At least in Britain and America, there's intense debate about the morality of that war. And both Bush and Blair have suffered very, very seriously. You know, their reputation has been seriously damaged. But look at John Howard, avuncular John, Uncle John, who no one sort of is willing to say, look, you went to this war, which was an illegal war, and the consequences have been absolutely disastrous.
Mm.
At least the British had that very, very long, the Chilcot inquiry that went on for years and came out with a very, very severe attack on the fact that Britain went to war. We've done nothing. There's been no attempt to consider why we went to war, whether it was legal, whether we gained anything from it, and what did it cost us, and what were the consequences. I mean, the whole Middle East. You know, they attack. You know, he's a dictator, but he's secular. He's a Ba'ath socialist. He's secular. Much of his violence is keeping the religious fanatics down, and we go in and knock him off, and we wonder why the whole thing then just erupts. I mean, and we don't seem to want to have any moral responsibility for what happened. I think we sort of feel, oh, it's their war, we're just going along to help.
Mm.
And as long as we perform well and our soldiers, are true Anzacs, true diggers, well, that's all right.
Mm.
That's all we need to do. But that is an extremely immature attitude to take to war.
Mm.
Now, war is serious and tragic and terrible. And we, I think, like to see it almost as a sport.
Mm. It's part of this sort of, I guess, you know, I remember my uncles and aunts would always refer to that as a sort of the colonial legacy, you know. It's this history of invasion and warfare, and it becomes part of the narrative or identity of, you know, of what we consider sort of Australia or for a lot of Western countries. But I, hearing you talk, that thing about morality, I always used to remember my old man, every Anzac Day, would say the way they sent those men to their death was absolutely criminal. You know, it was a virtually, a very bad position to actually come ashore and fight from, and they just kept sending wave after wave of people. And why don't we talk about that, you know? And why is that never around? It's like, how could those people knowingly do that?
Mm. Huh? And why, you know, why were we there to destroy the Ottoman Empire, which had kept the Middle East at peace for 500 years? I mean, there was conflict, but nonetheless, that incredibly diverse part of the world was kept in relative peace and stability by the Ottoman Empire. We go along and endeavour to smash it up. You know, in a part of the world we knew nothing about, I'm sure many of those young guys who went away in 1914 didn't even know where they were going. And some of them, apparently, when they got to Egypt, you know, they thought they were going to Europe, but of course they stopped off in Egypt for training. Some of them actually said, what are all these black people doing here? You know, why are they all these black people here?
They didn't know they were in Africa.
So it's going to war against people who aren't presenting any threat to you that you know little about. It's just utterly immoral. Mm. And it's that. And, I mean, it's not just my idea, but if you look at international law, you know, going a long way back, it's that war to be justified has to have good reasons, i.e. you are responding to an actual attack or a very likely attack. Now, most of Australian wars had nothing to do with that. You know, the Ottoman Empire was not going to attack Australia. The Boers in South Africa were not going to attack Australia. Even in the First World War, you know, the Germans actually would have preferred to negotiate with the British that the war would be confined to Europe. Now, that would have benefited the Germans, but at least it would have kept the war contained rather than turning it into a world war. As I say, leading to 70,000 young Australians dying. I mean, in my little village in Tasmania, and this is so all over the country, you know, there are 40 young men from that community died. And there were three brothers who came from the house I live in now. And that's just, and you know, that's almost every small town across Australia has got that. I mean, just terrible. But it's terrible if you were in the middle of Europe. Well, there were many countries in Europe that didn't go to war, you know. Holland, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Spain. They didn't go to war. And yet here we are on the far side of the world and we rush to get into it.
We'll just head to a song break. Warren Miller with his song Too Dark for the Light Horse.
Very, very appropriate.
He wore an issued Aussie soldier's uniform, with a rifle in his hand and a bayonet. But when he asked if he could be part of society, they said, no, you're not ready, not yet. But he fought hard for his country in the trenches, fighting hard beside his Aussie digger mates. When we look back in history, he helped change the course. But still, he's too dark for the light horse. Slouch hat on his head for the country, and he fired his gun in honor of the flag. But when he came back home from living hell, three letters he could not use, RSL. But he fought hard for his country in the trenches, fighting hard beside his Aussie digger mates. When we look back in history, he helped change the course. But still, he's too dark for the light horse. When we look back in history, he helped change the course. But still, he's too dark for the light horse.
This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
Welcome back to Let's Talk, and we're joined by a very special guest, Professor Henry Reynolds, and of course, Bo Spearham, regular host of Let's Talk. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about, in the media generally and across the country, there's been a lot of discussion following they're calling it desecration of the Captain Cook statue and Macquarie statue in Sydney.
Australian monuments.
And the desecration was essentially the way the caption read, Captain Cook discovered Australia in 1770 or whatever it is, and they spray painted over No Pride in Genocide.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These themes speak to something, you know, very much well about, Professor, in these different versions of history in this country.
Yep.
And we're seeing similar things go on in the US with the removal of Confederate heroes who fought on the wrong side, and the Confederate flag, statues that, you know, boast the Confederate flag, and the removal of these statues and the angst and the sort of debate and, you know, violence even that it stirred up for a lot of people there. What's your thoughts on where we find ourselves, you know, as a country here, as well as the US?
I was in America. I was in America for a month in May, and this was when the prison controversy started, when they began to move monuments. And in New Orleans was the first place that did. They actually did it at night by people in balaclava, so they couldn't be recognised. The companies doing it had their logos blanked over, and they had snipers around. Now,
well, it is America.
It is America. Yeah. Now, in some other places, it's been done just quietly, but as we know, it's still very contentious. Mm. And I can understand that. I mean, the American Civil War was a terrible war, and the South suffered, you know, most. You know, 600,000 people died in that war. So you can, because I'm an outsider, I can understand why people think you shouldn't have monuments celebrating these people who fought for slavery. On the other hand, there are those people who say it's part of our Southern tradition, you know, blah-de-blah, and we want them to remain. So, and the New York Times produced a map showing all the Confederate monuments across the South, and there are hundreds of them. So, it is bound to be an ongoing contentious question. And that's because America still, there's no doubt it still lives in the shadow of slavery. You know, that was brought to an end in the 1860s, but as we know, the ongoing consequences of slavery continue to reverberate. And there's no doubt that there's still that profound question in America about the legacy of slavery. Now, in Australia, in America, I thought, well, are we going to have something like this in Australia? And it happened much more quickly than I was expecting. Because we have our own issues. We have our own issues. And the question about pioneer monuments, about the many names, you know, that like Black Nigger Creek or Murdering, you know, there are many, many such names scattered about the map. But there are also many monuments and names of people who undoubtedly had blood on their hands. There's no question about that. And so we have to think what we're going to do about that. Now, my view is that such monuments should be amended. Let's take Captain Cook. Now, what I think should happen is that the La Perouse people, because after all, he wasn't in Sydney, he didn't go into Sydney, he was in Botany Bay, the La Perouse mob should be asked to design a counter statement that could go on the other back of the monument saying, James Cook visited our country, da 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 da, giving their version of the history. And that would be, I think, a way to make the monument relevant again. But it also it's useful in an educational point of view to show that there are these quite different interpretations and they can be on the same monument. And if necessary, you know, add other bits. Now, there's one very interesting monument in Fremantle, and it's been there, you know, it's been changed for quite some time, 20 years or so. There was a monument put up in the 1880s to the pioneers. There were three, worthy pioneers who went north to the Pilbara, and they were killed by the locals. And so they put up this monument similar to the one, you know, I said about Santa Fe. That is, the heroic whites were killed by the savages, you know, da-da-da-da-da. Now, a group of students at Murdoch University got in contact with the people from the area where these chaps were killed, because there was then a punitive expedition. They went up and they just shot people for, you know, as punishment. So they asked the local people to work with them to prepare a counter-statement. Mm-hmm. And because it was a progressive council, they agreed, and it's there on the monument. But it just makes that monument infinitely more significant and important. And I think that should be done all over the country. I think to pull monuments down, you're just going to... It's going to be fodder for the Australian and the right wing, you know, absolute fodder. So I think to amend them And in the case of Botany Bay, I mean, there are people who are descended from those who met Cook, and they should have their say.
I was thinking the caption under, you could have Captain Cook discovered Australia in 1770, 60,000 years after after the Euro people.
absolutely no reason. There's no reason why monuments should be frozen in time.
Mm.
You can't change the monument necessarily, but you can certainly change the way it's going to be interpreted.
Mm.
Definitely.
I think there's still, there seems to be the amount of conversation debate that went on in the media, there still seemed to be a really sort of unresolved sense of these different accounts, though. Mm. And I mean, I recall, you know, what they'd called the history wars, you know, and following and part of that media coverage was people like, you know, Keith Winshut and stuff coming back out and talking about, you know, this, again, we call this different accounts of history. Like, are there different accounts, or are they just sort of, or is there one sort of history and only certain sides that we've heard?
Well, two things. One, there are obviously different sides, and particularly in this case, that is the local people and Captain Cook, but also it's not just the different viewpoints from different groups.
Mm.
It's also the way understanding of the past changes over time, and it partly changes because the present changes.
Mm.
So that as the present moves, you start to get different view, different angles on the past. So history is always going to change. I mean, that's what keeps it dynamic and vital. And so monuments have the disadvantage of being literally set in stone.
Mm.
There's absolutely no reason why we can't have a set up a whole, you know, the Monuments Australia as an organisation, give them the job of arranging where communities want to have an alternative view put on a monument. Now, that will take fights and local governments and other groups, but that seems to me to be the sensible way to do it.
Mm. Like a touch-up crew.
Yeah.
And just update our monuments. Yeah.
Well, like, that's that whole big discussion here in West End with Boundary Street as well.
Yeah.
With the history of Boundary Street here, yes.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Well, I guess of any area that has had a Boundary Street.
Yeah. So what do they say? They want to change the name?
Well, yeah, like, there was discussions of changing the name, and some mob come along and said, well, you know, I think it's best it stays, you know, so then it's a part of that whole that's educational right.
thing. There's an explanation of why it was called that. Just as I think there should be something up there on the South Bank to say that the black American soldiers weren't allowed to cross over, were they? They were confined to South Bank. Those things are just as worthy of putting up something to remember that fact than, you know, the more obvious thing.
A lot of them got arrested and was mistaken for blackfellas. You know, spent a couple of nights in the watch house.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, there was this one instance, I think it was a jazz player, a very, very famous jazz player from the States, came over here, went into, you know, a certain area, got picked up by the cops, you know, eventually got out, went back into America, all these big articles, you know, well, you know, we're coming out slamming Australia for, you know, arresting, you know, the wrong person.
Famous case where the musicians were actually consorting with white girls, you know, which was, you know, that was outrage, and I think the police did raid them and maybe deported them. I can't remember the detail, but anyway, those parts of our history are important to remember, and I don't see why, you know, we can't indeed put up explanations because these things get forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important for us to remember that Australia, you know, does have a black history, but it also has a history of massive discrimination against non-Europeans, you know. I think it's important that we remember that. Now, it's vivid in my mind because I can remember back when, you know, the White Australia policy was still seen as sacred.
Mm.
But for young people growing up now, they probably don't understand that is, you know, within living memory.
Mm-hmm.
Just as the way, which, as you know, particularly in you know, outback towns, people were still being treated in those dreadful ways, you know, right up to the present.
Mm.
And this is the thing, you know, when you're telling that story, and our people, we've always had these stories, you know. Mm-hmm. We've always known what's happened here, and you know, and I guess that history wars, we actually started to see a turn of the tide and work from people like yourself about saying, well, actually, these things did happen, you know, and for a long time they were just the stories that were handed down through our communities and our families, you know. And it speaks to that sense of, I guess, you know, history being dynamic and that it does change, particularly over time. What is your sense of how we're tracking in terms of reconciling ourselves as a country or coming to some form of national identity? I mean, and it touches on the stuff we spoke about earlier about, you know, our allegiances when it comes to time of war, how we view our history. Yeah. Where do you think we are sort of on the path of sort of progress, I guess, as a country?
Well, it's, you know, it's a big topic, so it's a complex story. I think there is a growing sense that this is where we belong. You know, we white fellas, this is where we belong. And this is where, you know, this is our country. And we don't want to be part of the British Empire. So, I mean, I think the Republic is a profoundly important change. Even if it doesn't come quickly, it has to happen for Australia to be able to seriously present itself to the world as having its own identity. And I think in the arts, in painting and literature and song, all of these things, I think there is a great deal of people coming to terms. Mm. And one of the most important parts of that is indeed coming to terms with the history of relations between Europeans and Indigenous people going back to, you know, the beginning of settlement, but also this realisation that we sit upon a vast history behind us, you know, and that is probably one of the most important things, because the view was in the old days, oh, we haven't got so little history, we must look to Britain, you know. Mm. But, you know, we've got this dense ancient history of the land, and I think that's very, very important, and that is undoubtedly influencing the wider society. But of course, one of the things about Australia is because we have such a rapid influx of people, you can't be sure how that melting pot is going to end up.
Mm. Well, it came out sort of in the Uluru Statement and the Convention, you know, this idea that by reconciling or coming to some sort of terms of the relationship with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and the country more broadly will actually aid and assist in that formation of what, you know, what sort of country we are now, what sort of country we exist in.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. See, one of the things that what I find quite extraordinary is that we are still unable to recognise that what happened in Australia was a war.
Mm.
It was a war. It was a different sort of war, but it went on for a very long time. It was, it accompanied Australian history for 140, 150 years. I mean, that large group in the centre of Tasmania killed something like 250 Europeans. This was a serious war. This was a serious war. And yet, although people at the time said, we should regard these people as patriots who have died for their country. Now, this is a country that makes a fetish of war.
Mm.
And yet we can't see that we should be embracing these people as those who fought against the enemy. That is, the enemy was the British Empire. Now, where I was most struck by this was in Chile, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Chile, there's, as you probably know, there's still a very large group of the Mapuche Indians. There are a million or more of them. Very, very powerful group. But they fought the Spaniards. And the Indian chiefs who fought the Spaniards are Chilean heroes.
Mm.
That is, the greatest work of literature in old Chile was one celebrating the Indian chief. There's a statue of him sitting up on a promontory in the middle of Santiago, and in the officers' messes, they don't toast the Queen of Spain, they toast the Indian chief, because he fought the Spaniards.
Mm.
So he is our hero.
Mm.
Now, that's what happens if you are independent and you've long ago broken your ties with Spain. You don't have to feel you've got to identify with the British. And that takes a great shift. A great shift. And that's my view, that when people say, oh God, we were so bad to the indigenous people, well, yes, we were, but the fundamental problem was what the British did, not, you know, because they decided to settle Australia, giving no recognition to the sovereignty or to even the property. In effect, they expropriated the private the property of the indigenous nations initially over the whole of Eastern Australia. It was one of the greatest land thefts in history. You know, and when the Nazis expropriated Jewish people and the various communists expropriated, you know, the class enemies, we said, oh, that was shocking. But the British came in and said, these people are savages, we will take their land. It will all become Crown land. Now, that was a crime on a vast scale. That's why we shouldn't be celebrating the 26th of January. It wasn't just they arrived, it's what they did. And we should see that as a terrible thing, but in a way, that set the history off on a course that was hard to change. But that was what they did, not what we did. You know, I don't identify with England or Britain. It wasn't my ancestors that actually created the conditions that would lead to the conflict. It was what the British did. And in a way, that's one of the great hurdles we've got to get over. And, you know, when I say these things, people think, God, oh.
What do you think? Well, obviously, it's obvious that, you know, Australia doesn't want to own someone, like, own that history. Do you ever see that, you know, Australia's going to own that history? And then what happens when they own that history? How does that change the conversation?
Well, you know, I'm currently working with the Education Department in Tasmania, the Aboriginal education people. I've also worked with the Catholic system in New South Wales, and apparently here in Queensland there's going to be a new course, and I was in touch with a young woman just the other day about writing the new textbook about frontier conflict. So I think it is happening. But apart from you see, what the trouble is, that if you say, oh God, all these people kill people, say, oh, that's terrible, we don't want to know about it. You know, you drive them away. But if you can turn it around and say, let's celebrate the heroism of our people, our First Nations, heroically fought to try and preserve their way of life and their country. Now, that's a great story.
Absolutely.
That's a great story. And the greatest contrast between the settlement of Queensland in the 1860s, 1880s, that period, okay? At the same time, the Canadians were settling the prairies from the Great Lakes to the Rockies.
Yeah.
Huge areas.
Yeah.
In Queensland, we've got no idea, maybe 40,000 people were killed. Settling the Western Canada, none were killed. It was done by treaties. And the Royal Mounted Police were there to protect the Indians.
And did you say that around the same time?
Yeah. With the same sort of settlers, the same sort of institutions, the same British laws. It's just that they began with the idea that because this had been the old way, you recognised that they had property rights, you recognised that they had sovereignty, so you had to negotiate. They had something to negotiate about. So indeed, you negotiated, and they're called the numbered treaties. And people now say, I'm the numbered treaty four mob. That is, the treaties still exist. Now, it means that they did get pushed into reserves, into much smaller areas. But nonetheless, it was a process that happened that avoided the terrible violence in Queensland at almost the same time. You know, and as I say, you couldn't do that in Queensland because the British had decided that at the very start. These people, they don't have any government, they don't have any laws, they don't have any property, so there's nothing we can negotiate about.
It's, you know, when we talk about that acceptance of Indigenous stories and heroes, you know, the vast difference between, you know, just mob over the ditch, New Zealand, You know, they have a treaty, and they have much more a stronger embrace and understanding and appreciation of the of the Maori history, and you know,
and the Maori War is a important part of their history.
Yeah, but the culture as well. You know, they people understand and acknowledge and appreciate the language and place names and that sort of stuff in their history. We don't see that because, as you said, from the very start, the foundations weren't right. There wasn't an acknowledgement of sovereignty. There wasn't an acknowledgement of rights. Yeah. You know, Mabo's been sort of a step in that direction of managing that and dealing with that. Yeah. But we still got a ways to go, I guess, in terms of forming that understanding and that relationship.
And it takes time because people basically go on, believing the things they learnt when they were at school.
Mm.
And they carry that through their life.
Mm.
And so, changes on this scale take time. But I do think that all over the place, the education systems are changing. I mean, the Catholic system is indeed going to introduce all over the Catholic schools in New South Wales a whole section on the frontier wars. So it is gradually now infiltrating, the education, as it will in Tasmania. I think the government of Tasmania has virtually given them, plenty of money and said, go for it. So I think, we're very well aware that youngsters will come in with the views of their parents and they will be, confronted by some, and some of them will be, distressed. Some of them will be aggressive and they'll go back to their parents and their parents will get, it's it's not an easy process.
Mm. No, it's not. And it's not a quick process.
No.
And it's a long ways to go. Bo, did you have another song for us to play before we finish up?
Yeah, Titters with our song Anthem.
Very good. Another very appropriate song.
Yes.
Speaking about the difference of opinions and understandings of history. Mate, we were speaking just briefly there about, students who get challenged in the classroom. I've told this story on air a couple of times, but I remember going to university and sitting in rooms full of people, learning about, for the first time, some of the things that happened to this country. And we do see that reaction. There is a sense of shock, horror, a full range and gamut of emotions from being upset to angry and uncomfortable. But it's an important conversation, and you played a very important and integral role in creating that conversation. So from us here, we acknowledge your contribution to that and appreciate your efforts over many years, and hope you go well today in your lecture. And thanks again for coming out.
It's a pleasure.
Don't sing me an anthem, 'cause you don't know the words. Words are hard to remember when they mean nothing at all to the heart who's still waiting for their voice to be heard. Don't sing me your anthem when your anthem's absurd. We might have been born here, but we're not young and free. We weren't born yesterday, an neoliberal by degree. This land may be beautiful, but it cannot be healthy. So don't sing me your anthem till we've learned how to share. We are the lucky country where anyone can win. If you were born to the right, their voice to be heard.